because I got high, because I got high.
Go to the next, go to the next, go to the next.
I was gonna go to work, but then I got high. Ooh, I just got a new promotion, but I got high. La-da-da, now I'm selling dope, and I know why.
Why?
Because I got high, because I got high, because I got high. La-da-da-da-da-da, I was gonna go to court before I got high. I was gonna pay my child support, but then I got...
Oh, I just want you all to know that I was forced to do that by Officer.
That's my ghetto police.
They gave me 30 seconds notice to get that one out.
Yeah, Liam pulled that one right out of air.
What if we played Afro Man? Yeah, he should. Yeah,
we'll make it happen. You should have told me that 5 minutes ago. Nothing like waiting. Ah, well, sure, we could start off just with regular stuff, but that's not very fun. So, welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff.
Want to segue that into some sort of tractor talk?
You know, why don't I? I can do that. Our sponsor this hour is
Pape. Because you
don't
go buy a tractor if you get high, right? That's another bit. That's another downside.
No.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Are you all done?
Maybe
Bill
not.
Is not going to sell somebody a tractor under the influence of marijuana. He's an expert at it, and no one's sitting on that tractor.
Yeah.
All right, Bill. Tell us about that.
Okay. So our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, a drug-free workplace. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer, and they stock and sell pretty much anything John Deere. Go up and see them. They have a great inventory right now. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, or you can give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. They got some great financing right now, 0%.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to pay them to take the tractor.
Yeah, they haven't gone that low yet, but it's still available. Go up and talk to them, and they'll make you a great deal.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Bill loves it when we help segue him into his sponsorship.
Oh, I do. I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kay. Not.
Oh, that's when the beauty of radio takes over, because they can't see us all falling out of our chairs laughing. Old Bill's trying to keep a straight face. So our guest, the first hour, and our hostage, the second hour, is Dr. Ken Finn. And before we took a break, we were getting into that whole messy area of cause and effect. How about that?
Yeah. Well, he had mentioned, the mass shootings. I'm curious, has anybody actually done a study on these shootings? How many of the shooters are marijuana users?
Well, he said he was waiting on Uvalde. How long do you think that'll take, Dr. Finn, or do you think we'll ever find out?
So, I think we will find out at one point, but, historically when I've gone down this road of trying to figure out what their substance use was from a mass shooter, it can take weeks to months, and I found that if the shooter is alive, just forget it, because it's going to be an ongoing investigation. They go on trial. They're incompetent, not incompetent, like the Boulder shooter, the King Super shooter from a couple years ago. he killed several people up in Boulder at the grocery store. He's still waiting for trial, and the Planned Parenthood shooter here, who moved to Colorado to smoke weed with people, and his girlfriend had a medical marijuana card. That's like 7-8 years, and he's still deemed incompetent to stand trial. So we may never know on him. So I found that if the perpetrator is dead, it typically is easier to get the toxicology results. Although there are some states, like Florida, for example, they consider the toxicology part of the medical record, despite the heinous crime the person committed. And I think Nevada is another one of those states. And some states, this is where it gets even more interesting. Like Maryland, for example, will test everything under the sun except marijuana. They'll test for antidepressant medications,
really?
and anti-inflammatories, but they won't test for marijuana. This is the state of Maryland.
And what's their excuse for that?
How many are we missing?
Is that just because the marijuana lobby is so strong there that they keep that all hush-hush?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that. It's just so fascinating to me that there's no standard of testing. Like even the federal five, which should be the federal six with fentanyl, you know, you're talking about cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, marijuana, and there was another one that you should test in the emergency department. Some places are getting rid of the marijuana requirement to even test. So, but I don't know what the force behind that. I don't know if it's marijuana lobby. Yeah. I don't know if it's just
Well, it's not a big mystery. I mean, gosh, any reporter can do a little background on some of these people, talk to friends, family. Hey, did they smoke pot? That's all it takes, you know. And I mean, I know that's not scientific, but
no, and that's the reason that I'm very particular about getting the report in hand,
right?
Because we have a lot of examples of people that were created mass shootings and said, well, they had a history of smoking marijuana. Well, that doesn't give it to me. Like, I just watched this little very short series on Netflix on the Boston bombers. I think the younger bomber, Boston bomber, was a marijuana dealer in college, and both of them reportedly escalated their marijuana use before they pulled that act. But we don't know what the relationship is between that. So it's hard to, you know, there's a correlation for sure, but is there a causative effect? We don't know.
Yeah.
And that's what makes marijuana so covert and insidious, is because it doesn't work like alcohol, doesn't work like opioids.
Right.
You know, we can't do real good. We don't have a breathalyzer for marijuana. It just doesn't work the same way. You know, it's fat soluble. It's not water soluble. It's just different. And that's what I think makes it so challenging in these particular cases. Like me and David Logg in Thousand Oaks, I killed 12 or 14 people. I have his toxicology, and there's only one thing in the system, and very high levels. So did he become psychotic because of his marijuana use? I don't know. But we do know that there was only one substance in his system, and we know that the more recent data shows increased psychosis with more frequent use and higher potency products.
Mm-hmm.
And killed a Ventura County Sheriff Sergeant, I might add, during that shooting.
Yeah.
So, Ken, we had talked about medical examiners and coroners, and you said you're making some success there. What about what's your thoughts about departments of health and where they're going with marijuana? And you can also segue into the FDA. Where do you think it's going with the FDA?
Ooh, well, let's start with the. Let me go back to the coroners and medical examiners.
Okay.
It really, there's no standardization across the country on testing. So that's a big black hole. So if you have, for example, a mass shooting or a murder or what have you, depending on the jurisdiction, they may not test at all. And there is a place, you mentioned something about, do we know anything about marijuana users? And there's something called the Violence Project. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No.
So you go to their website, and it's very interesting. I looked at some of their data, and me and a couple other people looked at their data, and it's somewhat flawed because we found several examples of mass shootings that they said had no marijuana in their system, but we have the toxicology report. And the Violence Project goes back to mass shootings from 1966, right? And we discovered that more than 53% of the mass shootings in the U.S. have occurred since 2012. Correlating with more states expanding marijuana use and access. But we found a lot of their data was missing. So I think it actually may be a little higher than that. And so I think that there's something happening with these mass shootings and cannabis, that there's some relationship there, but I can't really put my finger on it. And some coroners and medical examiners don't have to test, so I think they're missing a lot.
Is it something at a local level that we can demand or request that all of them be tested? Or I just think if it was across the board.
Yes, we actually try to work with the National Academy on Medical Examiners, and they kind of gave us a stiff arm. And these are doctors. I said, we try to submit a proposal to speak at their national conference on, you know, when are you going to start considering marijuana as a potential cause of death or contributing factor. For example, there was Jelani Day in Illinois was a young man whose last known location was at a marijuana dispensary and was found a few days later floating in a river. And so I had a discussion with the coroner in that area, and I said, I understand the cause of death was drowning, but he had a fairly high level of THC in his system. I said, what do you think about that? He goes, not an issue. I said, well, what if there was alcohol in his system? Well, that would be a contributing factor. I said, what if there were opioids in the system? That would be a contributing factor. And we know that marijuana can precipitate sudden death, which you're not going to see on an autopsy, and arrhythmia, which you may not see on autopsy, as well as seizure, which you're not going to see on autopsy. So you have a young man with positive THC, and the coroner said, not a contributing factor. And I sent him all the information. He still wouldn't change his opinion. But I do ask, I said, if you haven't tested for THC or cannabinoids, can you do that? And sometimes it's hard to differentiate between, is it the dispensary cannabis that they're using or black market cannabis or the synthetic cannabis? You can do, because the coroners always say, we don't have enough money to look for cathinones, which are the metabolites of the synthetic THC. So they won't even test for it. So that's why I think there's a lot of missing data out there. And I think the Violence Project, even though they're federally funded, created their own definition of a mass shooting and don't use the federal definition of a mass shooting. So I think that their data is flawed, and they're missing a lot of information. But again, more than 53% of the mass shootings that had marijuana associated occurred in the past 10 years.
Wow. All right, Liam had a question for you.
I agree with you in the sense that marijuana might have played some kind of role in mass shootings. But I don't think it's very fair to make a blanket statement that since 2012, marijuana has like caused mass shootings.
No. I don't. I hope you didn't misunderstand me.
Okay.
I just said the presence of marijuana in mass shootings. 53% of the presence of marijuana in mass shootings has been since in the past 10 years.
Okay.
I didn't say there was a causal relationship.
Okay.
No.
Cool. Just clarifying, because that's dangerous.
Yeah. I can't say it's causal. I just think it's at the dance a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And the fact that we're not studying it means that we're unlikely to be able to prove that one way or the other. What was your sense of it? With you said that you talked to the people that actually control what the coroners do and all that. When you spoke to them on a national scale, why did they not want to look at that?
They always said it came down to funding. That they don't. They sometimes won't do it because they will. They don't have the money in their lab to test for. I'm like, it's the federal five. You should be testing it anyways, right?
Right, but if they can test for the others, I don't understand why would this cost more? Are we missing something on the complexity of this?
Exactly. And why does the state of Maryland refuse to test it? I mean, they have like 200 medications that they test that include illicits and all that other stuff, but they don't even test for the synthetic or natural cannabinoid.
Wow.
Why? I don't have an answer for that. So what are they missing? What's the state of Maryland missing?
I'll tell you what they're missing. They're missing, for example, in California, 20 of the largest farms are capable of producing more than 2.6 million pounds of marijuana, enough to supply our legal market, except law enforcement's determined that 70% of licensees, 60% of cannabis grown in California is unlicensed. And so that's not even included into what the state is actually saying they can control. So we have all this unlicensed cannabis out there with these unknown adulterants in it. Is it any wonder that we have, you know, the issues that we're seeing now?
Well, because if you're not testing, A, you can't know if it's the marijuana itself.
Right.
But you absolutely can't. It's impossible to know the chemical compounds that came along with it if you're not even testing for the main substance.
Right.
Exactly.
I guess. I could say if there's some good news, Ken, and I know you know this.
What?
We know
you're gonna wreck the whole show?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's good and bad. We know that the legal market has failed here in California, and I'll be interested to your read in Colorado, Ken, because the price of marijuana has dropped so low now that you're really getting the illegal market, the dregs of the illegal market is growing, growing marijuana now, and that's what's flooding As other states come on board, it's actually taking some pressure off of California, but there's such a glut of marijuana. What are you seeing in Colorado in reference to that?
And I'm terribly sorry, but it is I, the fun killer.
It's going to take us to a break?
Yeah. Okay. We have to have a little break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Ken Finn.
But more rock music with Aaron.
And you're listening to We the People.
I can't get these memories out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to evolve. I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Stop smoking pot. Just a thought.
And you won't be crazy in the night.
Yeah, there you go. What could she do? I'm sorry. So I was busy being the fun killer, and I forgot what we were supposed to come back with.
So Ken was going to tell us about Colorado and what's going on there as far as the changes compared to California. Is there a glut of marijuana there? Are dispensaries going out of business? Those kind of things.
I'm hearing the same thing. I don't know if it is as prevalent as it is in California. I know that the black market is thriving under legalization. We've got a lot of black market activity and cartels across the state, and I think that's what takes up a lot of our law enforcement time and energy is battling the black market grows, and they're. It's like whack-a-mole. I'm sure you're dealing with the same thing. It's like as soon as you put one out here, there's another one popping up there, and it could be the same people. You know, and the state isn't really aggressive. The DAs aren't willing to prosecute a lot of these things. They do come back like cockroaches, and they end up in the same house. And we have examples of illegal grow houses in Colorado, for example, that owned several houses in this one little area, and the entity that owned those homes had ties to Miami that had a Cuban bank affiliation. So you can backtrack it. And actually the person that owned that particular LLC was the name of a dead person that lived in the neighborhood years before. So it's like, but the state lets it go. We have examples of a large warehouse in southern Colorado that the registered agent was a 14-year-old girl. That was rubber stamped by the state. I mean, it's just an absolute disaster.
Yeah. Well, we have the same problem here. A lot of these illegal grows, you can't find the owner. I mean, they change the owner's name so often. I mean, you spend your entire time chasing a ghost, and in the meantime, they just continue to grow.
No pun intended.
The only hope that we have for our county is a good sheriff who's going after marijuana and destruction orders from the judges. Where a lot of counties in California are not able to get that, we do get that. So our marijuana team can go after with a skid steer and bulldoze, you know, $100,000 worth of infrastructure. It takes them more than 72 hours to come back.
Well, it also takes funding that they have to get approved, and that seems to be a big stumbling block.
So, Ken, some statistics from the FAA. You know, we have, of course, drug driving, and now we have all of these passengers on airplanes flying under the influence. And that statistic this year put out by the FAA is there's been a 2,500% increase just this year and an increase every year since it's been tracked from 2017. And we're talking about airline flight crews having to deal with people coming out of the lavatories or actually vaping in their seats, and they have to act as police on aircraft. I'm wondering if under the classic signs of addiction where someone can't stop using for even an hour or two-hour flight, what do you think? I mean, under the classic word addiction, are they addicted if they can't stop and they have to use while they're getting on an airplane for whatever reason?
By definition, that's addiction. But we've been terribly disappointed with the FAA. They really are reluctant to respond to our requests for drug testing. And I don't know the world of, you know, airline travel. You know, if you're up in the air, who is jurisdiction? If they leave California and they're going to Florida, you know, and in the middle of the flight, somebody has an episode. We don't know what, you know, when they land, obviously that's where the law enforcement comes involved. But they don't test really at all, these people. They say, well, they're just impaired and they're unruly. But there's no mandate to test for anything, really, including cannabis and some of these unruly passengers that we're aware of. And we've done several requests. One of the people we work with, who hopefully is listening still, we found an example of a mechanic, an airline mechanic, who was threatened because he was going to be turned in to a supervisor for his chronic, ongoing, consistent marijuana use as he's tinkering on jet airliners. Oh, that's wonderful. A frightening data point. We have that information. I mean, it's not like we're making it up.
As in the medical world, we're always worried about what a doctor can be under the influence of. Doctors are not allowed to be under the influence of marijuana, are they? Or can they use it as well?
You bring up a really scary point.
Yeah.
It's a very scary point. I can tell you that, you know, some of the hospitals don't do employee testing on their physicians. They don't test for cannabis. They got rid of it. We do know that this is obviously hearsay, but I was giving an interview for Channel 9 in Denver by a physician, and she's like, oh, yeah, a couple of my friends who are surgeons tell me that they take a hit off a vape pen before they go in the ER because it calms their nerves. I'm like, well, I go, don't. She goes, do you wonder who they are? I go, no, if I know who they are, I have a duty to report. You should have a duty to report. You know, they could be impaired. I mean, would you, one, have your gallbladder taken out knowing that your surgeon and anesthesiologist may have been, you know, taking a hit off a dab last night?
Only if I wanted a sponge left inside.
Can persist down the road, even though you feel fine, you know, 24 hours later. They've done, you know, simulated pilot studies and driving studies that people can still be impaired.
We're seeing that. Later. We're seeing that attack. That I call it an attack from the industry here in California, where you're seeing unions, i.e. fire department unions or state fire unions, where employees are saying that when they're off duty, they should be able to use marijuana, and they're being backed up. And now they tried it in law enforcement, but since it's federally illegal, law enforcement said, nope, you can't do it. But it's constantly, that law is constantly being attacked by the unions.
You know, when you get into the anesthesia realm, I'm thankful because I've been trying to, you know, like again, I said earlier, I felt like an Army One Forever, but there's an organization called ASRA, which is the Anesthesia Society of Regional, there's a American Society of Regional Anesthesia, and they came out with a consensus statement stating that you should be screening your patients that are having surgical procedures. And I'm so glad they did it. I published a paper like 2 years before saying kind of the same thing, but I was ignored because I'm just me, a little solo practitioner in Colorado. But you had a group of, you know, probably 8 or 10 well-known physicians saying you have to screen your patients because there are problems for patients undergoing anesthesia. There's drug interactions. They have, they're harder to put to sleep.
Right.
They're harder to keep asleep. They have trouble with their medication management post-op. So, and a lot of the data is very is there about, you know, they have poor sleep, they have higher, you know, perhaps higher costs, hospitalization costs, difficult to maintain, manage their pain, they consume more opioids post-op, because there's a very intricate link between the opioid and cannabinoid system, which we probably don't have enough time to go into, and we're happy to explain it down the road, but they're very, very tightly connected. And that's why I think that, you know, there's something there about the analgesic properties, but, you know, give me a cannabinoid that's proven to be effective and doesn't have fungus in it.
It doesn't need a blowtorch.
And proven to be effective, and I'm fine with that. But those products don't exist.
Yeah, and really, when you go into an operation and something goes wrong with the anesthesia, who are they going to go after? And here, this poor guy had no idea. The guy was half high on pot when he administered
anesthesia. Did they ask you that?
Anesthesia. I
don't know. I don't remember.
I was going to ask Ken, as far as pre-op instructions, you know, is cannabis use now being on a regular basis being asked of patients? And if so, if they admit it, because many probably would deny, if they admit it, is that a prerequisite for denying an operation?
No, I think it's not being ubiquitously screened. I think people are moving in that direction. One of my colleagues here in town, I heard, didn't get it straight from him, but I heard he canceled somebody's surgery unless they stopped smoking for 2 weeks. They wanted it completely out of their system.
Good for him. Good for
because,
him.
You know, we know it can persist. So
if you're taking, all right, so let's go back to the driving, right? So you go back to the driving and somebody's in some sort of an accident, well, you don't have time to get anything out of your system. You're rushed to the hospital and there's stuff being done. So potentially, I'm assuming they would not test for that before they would treat you.
No, when in an emergent situation, they just treat you.
Yeah. So all this interaction business then throws off a second wave of terror.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like the anesthesia, it's like, why can't I keep this person asleep? What's going on? And there's no history.
Right.
They may be unconscious from their car crash.
Sure.
And they're just trying to.
So if they're long-time pot users,
so they can get their surgery done.
The anesthesiologist.
Right. It counteracts.
Yeah, they can't keep them asleep. That is so weird.
But yet people use it to help sleep.
Okay, that's where I was.
Right.
Yeah, the wheels in my mind were turning. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't get it.
I could see them.
I'm like, why are you taking it to sleep if it makes you stay awake?
You know, it's so interesting because there's this debate about whether or not it's a sleep aid. Again, we haven't studied it enough. And when I read a lot of these publications, the thing that bothers me the most is like, well, cannabis might be effective treatment for pain. And then you go look for the devil in the details, and they don't tell you anything about the products that people are using.
Right.
Are they using a 10% product? Are they using a 90% product? And what's going on there? And that's why I think a lot of these studies are flawed, because there's no good consistency and documentation of what these people take. And they just say, well, cannabis helps for pain.
What about your ability to, build a tolerance to it?
Exactly.
That's kind of an unknown.
Yeah. So my question here, too, is here in California, basically we decriminalized marijuana back in 1986. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's nobody in jail
for
marijuana.
Yeah, so quote-unquote nobody in jail. So since 1986, why have we been so slow to study this? I mean, we only recently have we, like people like you, have really dwelled into this product, and I just don't understand that. We've had years and years and years.
Yeah, because the reason they had to legalize it was so that they could regulate it and make it safe, blah, 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 blah.
Well, that's not completely true. I mean, if you actually go to clinicaltrials.gov, there have been over 30,000 studies on marijuana, despite its Schedule I classification.
Right.
And the government has spent billions of dollars on studying marijuana already. You know, I'm always supportive of ongoing research, and I think in this day and age, with more acceptance and more availability, I think there's more data coming out.
Right.
So I completely support it, but the study of cannabis has been going on since the way back in the day.
So spoiler alert that for us. What's it showing?
What's that?
What is it showing? What's that revealing, the study?
Oh, it's becoming a public health and safety disaster.
Right.
Really.
Yeah.
Especially when you
be.
Throw the environment, but you guys in California, when you throw the environmental impacts in there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just going to be terrible.
And the marijuana people have, they every time you turn around, they're engineering and coming up with some new product or some new THC element or, you know, how.
So much of it is chemical.
Yeah. There's. How do you study something that is just like this snowball?
It's you're chasing your tail,
right?
Because it's always evolving. Like these Dazz waxes and shatters didn't exist 15 years ago.
No,
they've only been recent, so we're really in uncharted waters. We don't know what's going to happen to the people that are using them in 10 years or 20 years from now. We already know the emerging data on women using during pregnancy. It's absolutely frightening what is happening to the offspring with their behavior, even though they're not using it. Middle childhood at 10 years of age, they have psychotic-like experiences. They have behavior problems, social problems at school. And, you know, NIDA just came out, followed up with that study, saying those problems persist into adolescence. So we're creating a new generation of we don't know what's going to happen, you know, drug-seeking behavior and violence and all this stuff as a result of in utero exposures. And not all women use during pregnancy, obviously, but the ones that are using regularly, the offspring are having problems.
Right.
That's been documented in both animal and human studies.
I'm curious to know, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I am curious to know what you're seeing with the effects on children. Because I know that they had recently in major media published that they were getting overdoses in like San Diego and that sort of thing. And I know here in Reading we had some kids who ate candy that was, obviously full of THC. It wasn't real candy. And I had people who were contacting, our local congressional office saying, well, we need to label it. It's like, I'm sorry, when was the last time a child read a candy wrapper? Mostly never. Grown-ups don't even read candy wrappers, and they look just like gummy bears, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to know if you've seen any studies or anything on that crossover, because I think that's actually just incredibly dangerous for our kids going forward.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So we're here with Dr. Ken Finn. Well, we're not really here with him. He's really on the phone. He lives in Colorado, but good for him for hanging out with us on Sunday afternoon. And you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Shed sleeping in an alley, didn't matter to me. I got lost walking in the valley. Well, it could have been 1993 when it goes badly after burning so bright. Trying to make sense of a hopeless situation, feels like dying in the middle of the night. When it goes badly, you're alone in the darkness. Nothing's ever gonna make it right.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. In a recent court case, Freed versus Garland, it was determined both medical and recreational marijuana users have no right to firearms because marijuana use was associated with elevated risky decision making. It is beyond dispute that marijuana users experience altered mental states that affect their judgment, creating irrational and unpredictable behavior. There is a clear relationship between the bevy of recent active shooters and marijuana use. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Tweeter and the Monkey Man were hot up for cash. They stayed up all night selling cocaine and hash to an undercover cop who had a sister named Jan. For reasons unexplained, she loved the Monkey Man. Tweeter was a Boy Scout before she went to Vietnam and found out the hard way nobody gives a damn. They knew that they'd find freedom just across the Jersey line, so they hopped into a stolen car, took Highway 99.
And the walls came down. All the way to hell. Never saw
little throwback song for you. So kids being affected by this new, you know, because back in the day, I mean, you knew marijuana when you saw it. I remember in school, remember, they'd bring out this is what marijuana looks like. This is what it smells like.
Well, Reefer Madness.
Well, there's that.
Yeah.
But I remember my dad
the
had.
The little clips.
Yeah. You know. But they had, like, little boards with all this stuff stuck to it, and they came and showed you all that stuff.
Yeah.
But now, I don't know, now it looks like gummy bears or whatever.
Or an inhaler. I love that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I forgot about that one. Inhaler, yeah.
Well, they banned candy cigarettes because it was a bad influence on kids, but it's okay to sell.
Let's get back to the candy cigarettes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, so what are you seeing in that? Is there any discussion in the wider venue about that, Dr. Finn?
Oh, yeah. The American Academy of Pediatrics had a paper that came out in January of this year showing that pediatric poisonings went up 1,300% in 4 years, 1,375% just between 17 and 21, so 4 years. 70% of those that had a known outcome had central nervous system depression. So, again, young children don't metabolize it like we do, and they can have problems. Nearly 23% of those kids ended up in the hospital. And, again, 4% end up on a ventilator.
How do you treat those kids medically, Doc?
Symptomatically. You just have to treat them. There's no antidote. There's no Narcan for marijuana poisoning.
Supportive care, ABCs.
Yep. Yes, supportive care. Let them write it out. The same with the elderly. I mean, my emergency medicine colleagues have had, you know, the 80-year-old grandma that came in from the nursing home because their grandkid thought it would be great for them to have a little marijuana cupcake for their birthday, and they end up catatonic, and, you know, they end up not responsive, and then they end up in the ER, and all they can do is just wait it out. They're clogging up space. But then, you know, they can run into drug interactions or have heart issues.
Oh, yeah.
So they have to monitor these patients because they can have trouble. But the pediatric poisonings is really frightening data. And the elderly that I mentioned earlier, that was an 1,800% increase in California, the elderly going to the ER.
Jesus.
Ken, if I recall, you also did put out a videotape at one point of an actual patient, without violating patient confidentiality, who was exhibiting hyperemesis. Was that you that put that out?
That was not me. That was, I think that was either Dr. Lev or Dr. Randall, both of which are emergency medicine physicians. And the one I saw was the audio, which is, you know, it's almost horrific. There's a term they call it scromiting, which is screaming and vomiting. And, you know, people have died from hyperemesis because of electrolyte imbalances and stuff. So don't let anybody say that marijuana has never killed anybody. It can. In the right situation. But when you have hyperemesis, you can even go to the Facebook page, Recovery from Hyperemesis Syndrome, Cannabinoid Hyperemesis Syndrome. They have like 20,000 followers. And just read some of the stories of some of these people that are affected. It just doesn't go away sometimes. I mean, they're sick for months and months sometimes. And it's just unbelievable that people say, well, I just feel a little nauseous. And again, that's kind of the circular thing with marijuana is that it's supposed to treat nausea, so people are using marijuana for the nausea, but the nausea persists, so they continue to use, and it's this vicious cycle, and they end up down this road with cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, and they're in the ER all the time, and the only treatment is stop using.
What about the treatment of hot showers, and then I also hear that using some antipsychotic medications or something like that is effective?
The hot showers is something that can mitigate some of the symptoms. Some patients have reported using that capsaicin cream, like the hot pepper cream, because it feels warm. But there's no real good treatment for the hyperemesis because it doesn't respond to the traditional antiemetics like Zofran or Phenergan. They just don't. And so the antipsychotics have been, there's some preliminary data like Haldol, which is an antipsychotic medication, can mitigate some of the symptoms associated with hyperemesis. But I don't know as much about that research as some of my colleagues might, but that's what I've heard. But, you know, the ones that are ending up in the emergency department can be pretty sick sometimes, especially the little kids.
What about getting off marijuana and detoxing? That was the next subject we wanted to talk to you about, especially as a pain management specialist.
You know, it's so interesting you bring that up because I don't see a lot of marijuana addiction in my practice, but I know a lot of psychiatrists in the state. For example, I asked one of my colleagues in Denver who's affiliated with the university up there, I asked him about adolescents. I said, how many kids, what percent of your patient population are there for cannabis use disorder? Take a guess what his response was to me.
100%.
Very close, 97%.
Wow.
97%.
Wow. One for
Kathy. He treats adolescents with a variety. You know, kids use all sorts of stuff. But, you know, over time, he's seen the numbers increase to the point where the vast majority are there for cannabis use disorder. And those kids aren't in school to take surveys, like the Healthy Kids Colorado
survey.
Oh,
right, sure, right. That makes sense.
What's that?
Yeah, that makes sense. They're not there to take the surveys, so you don't know.
They're not there to take the surveys, right. But a lot of the states, you know, they promote their survey saying, hey, our kids are doing fine.
Yep.
I'm like, well,
the ones
that aren't doing fine can't take your stupid survey.
Okay, so when you talk about cannabis use disorder, so for people who are thinking, oh, what does that even mean? What does that even mean?
Cannabis use disorder is basically an addiction where you have a hard time stopping, and when you do stop, it has a very well-documented withdrawal syndrome. You have drug craving, you have sweating, you feel nauseous, you feel crummy. That's a cannabis use disorder. And historically, the numbers were, it's like 18% in the adolescent develop a cannabis use disorder and 9% in the adult. So people are like, well, it's not as addictive as some of these other things that we're dealing with, like nicotine and opioids. But the data's changed, especially as the products have morphed into more high potency. The addiction, the cannabis use disorder rates are now 30%. So they're up there with things like nicotine. Some of these strong products are very, very addictive. And when you have a cannabis use disorder, you have a hard time managing your use. It's not like, well, I'm just going to, you know, go out and take a hit off a bong on Saturday with my friends. It's like you're using more. You can't stop. It starts to control your life. And if you do stop, you have withdrawal. And that's, by definition, a use disorder.
Right.
And we know in society, we saw that Marijuana Biz Daily just put out the statistic that more marijuana is consumed by Americans now than beer or chocolate.
And, what?
Yep. And it's approaching cigarettes. So the use in our country is just skyrocketing. And we don't know. That's the legal use. We have no idea what the illegal use is, where it's coming from illegal.
Oh, that's true. Well, it's interesting, too, that something that supposedly is not addictive, which is what you hear all the time.
It's nature's plan.
Yeah. It's not addicting. But it's kind of funny you have withdrawals from it.
Yeah, this is a big marijuana playbook. You remember the day? I don't know if you've ever caught the video of the big tobacco trials.
Yep.
And if they went down the line with all these executives saying nicotine's not addicting. And they boom, 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 boom.
And the doctors were smoking it.
Yeah. It doesn't cause cancer. Yeah.
Doesn't cause cancer. You know, it's an interesting topic, though. I mean, the cancer thing is not proven yet, especially lung cancer, which I'm somewhat surprised when people are smoking or vaping and doing this damage to their lungs. I just think we're not there yet. I think it didn't take, you know, we didn't know about lung cancer until tobacco was mass commercialized.
Right.
Because people back in the 1600s that were, you know, farming tobacco in the Carolinas, some of them probably got cancer. Maybe they didn't live long enough back then to develop cancer. We don't know, but we know that cancer didn't become a problem until mass commercialization. And I think that we're just in the early stages of that with marijuana, with the mass commercialization. So we won't know probably for 20, 30 years.
What harm we're doing. Yeah, and what's so sad is this is what we are leaving our children.
Yeah, exactly.
And we had Dr. Reese, and we interviewed him on this show. Aaron and Bill interviewed
him several times
and spoke about actual, was it changes to DNA, Aaron?
He was talking chromosomal about damage.
Chromosomal damage.
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Ken?
It's funny because I think one of his papers published about the autism rates in marijuana states compared to non-marijuana states are like 20% higher. And there's Susan Murphy from Duke University did some animal studies that, because they always point the finger at the woman, and, you know, God bless the women that have to, you know, bear children. You know, it's very painful. But the men that use marijuana, they alter the autism gene. I didn't even know there was an autism gene until I talked to Dr. Murphy at Duke University. But in the animal studies, they exposed the parent, the father rat to marijuana, and the offspring, even though the mom rat didn't get the exposed, the offspring had changes in their autism DNA.
Whoa.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Did not know that. Meanwhile, everybody's worried about, you know, all sorts of things causing autism, and one of the things is right in front of our face.
Yeah, but add it to the list. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the mom. That's the other thing. It's not just the mom. It's the dad's use.
Yeah.
So a lot of, so we don't know. And again, I'm going to use the term covert and insidious because I think it's there. You know, I think it's at the dance. A lot of these and all these things that we've talked about, it's there at the dance. But it's not being implicated.
In the last couple of minutes here, there are still a lot of people you know utilizing like the CBD products or the non-THC products, and they're being told that has no effects. Dr. Reese had a completely different take on that. What are you seeing on the physician side for that?
On using CBD compared to,
yeah, not even compared to, but as a safe medication, blowback alternative.
CBD suppository for whatever.
CBD
is not going to get you stoned like THC is, but it's certainly not benign. I already talked about the 575 right. drug interactions it has. There's only one FDA purified CBD on the planet. That's Epidiolex, and the people from Alabama that got it through the FDA actually wrote my chapter on seizure. It's very well done. But if you go to the Epidiolex website and you look at warnings and precautions, you're going to see, number one, liver damage, number two, suicidal behavior and ideation, and number three, sedation and somnolence. So I think it was the FDA or CDC had a warning on using CBD in driving because it can make you tired. I actually had a patient who was in her early 60s that tried CBD, and she became suicidal. So it's not benign. It has its own baggage, for sure, even though it's touted as being the safe alternative to THC. And there was a study out of Massachusetts that patients coming in an emergency department that were using a CBD-dominant product, nearly 30% of the time had no CBD in it. Again, my issue and my platform on product integrity. And the ones that had, and actually those products had a lot of THC in it. And the ones that were THC dominant, a lot of them didn't even, they had much higher levels of THC than was on the label.
Right.
I mean, so it's just kind of a disaster because it's mislabeling, it's patient safety.
As a consumer, you're at the mercy of the labeling unless you're secretly a scientist and you can run home and test everything before you take it.
Well, it's interesting. They put a warning label on CBD, but we don't get a warning label on
THC.
Yeah, kind of funny.
It's ironic.
we really appreciate all the work that you're doing in getting the word out and the Isaac website. It's IASIC1.org for people that are looking for information. And if you'd like to get a wider range of information, WeThePeopleRadio.us. There's a tab up top marked pot, and we've got video, audio, lots of different interviews. They are all commercial free, as this one will be later this afternoon. So we're not copyrighted. We do this program as a service to the public, so we hope that you will share it and use it to get the information from people like Dr. Finn out there. It's really worth it. Thank you very much for being on with us.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for the opportunity. You guys enjoy the rest of your weekend.
You thanks too. A bunch.
Thanks, Ken.
And we're looking forward to hearing from people if they want to. You can go to the website and email us if you'd like. It's WeThePeopleRadio.us.
For the wicked, money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got minds to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back, but you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.